Now, it still worked its way into some public health areas, did it not?
Yeah, it did. You know, just because something was dangerous, it didn't stop any of you know, any practitioners from using it. And I think that pretty much paints a big picture of where the ethics are. They were absent. This is science being driven by its own curiosity.
Or was there something more sinister involved? Could there have been? I mean, you know, we all know, people listening to this program know.
If we have a sinister thought system, and that would be eugenics itself, you know, we have to look at eugenics and figure out for ourselves if we think this is ethical.
Well, so basically what you're saying is that there are a lot of bizarre and terrible ideas circulating politically that could find their way to being married with this new technology, and then, and of course, what we find is a disaster waiting at the end.
Absolutely.
Well, now, we can move in for a moment and kind of bring the parallel time frame up with these... with the vaccine programs that got underway. What's the timing and the date and all the work for the vaccine stuff?
Well, you know, the very first vaccines were not necessarily this injectable kind. It was a reaction to work that Edward Jenner had done and Louis Pasteur had done. And vaccines were known. You know, they were inoculations. And you know now that doesn't have to be something administered by a syringe. A syringe sure makes it expedient, though. if you're asking about polio in particular, polio, of course, now with our vaccine, was the most massive of all vaccines.
And you made a statement that I'll refresh the people who are listening now here. You made a statement about the parallel nature of the Industrial Revolution and environmental pollutants growing up around the idea that polio is a disease apart from that, but in fact they're not separate. They're in fact one actually feeds into the other and causes it to be a much more pronounced condition. Am I correct?
Yes. Yeah. But what we have to take into consideration is what's known. Now, if you look back in history, the ancient Egyptians knew about polio. They described it. They had pictographs representing people who had polio. They had withered limbs and walking with sticks, things like that. So they knew it at that time to be an autoimmune condition for them. And it has never been anything else. That's what polio is.
It's an overtaxed immune system because it's weakened by environmental stresses, and that could be a poison or if you're working in a mine that's mining radon or whatever, and you're breathing it in. In other words, there are a lot of poisons that you can take into your body that could set you up for this condition to take effect.
Right.
Now, what you're talking about here is an environment where... The idea of inoculating against it, was that really to save people from it or to get people to get it?
Well, I think there are a lot of faulty assumptions that this is built on. And the main faulty assumption, germ theory. Germ theory was extraordinarily controversial. Look back at the failures of Jenner and the failures of Pasteur developing them. So it takes on the mantle of pseudoscience the first time, and it was very much a pseudoscience at this time as we come forward in time.
Now, when did this stuff get married to a political agenda that began to work its evil into our world? Because that's what ended up happening over time, and it was actually under the administration, and the programs were administered by the Flexner brothers. One, of course, in medical education, and one in, of course, the research side of things. And then, of course, the other brother, instrumental in setting up the Zionist State of Israel, the oldest brother. Now, these three brothers were pivotal in all of these different activities. When did it really start showing its evil side? If you'll excuse my you know, my meta-texting of this, you know, because I don't know if that's fair, but when did it start getting to having a bit of a supremacist kind of bent to it?
Well, I think when the first real experiments began, and I have to point that out, at 1903, the radon in the water.
Yeah.
That was an intentional experiment, and that was the beginning.
Yeah.
As far as marrying it to larger political objectives, those would just start to follow. It started coming like dominoes.
Every decade, a new series of different events.
Different large-scale laws and things.
All the way up until the 1918 flu, if I'm not mistaken, which was also, they said, was started in Kansas, given through inoculation to military people.
Well, I think that's really likely. I think, you know, I haven't specifically looked at tales of that.
Yep.
But looking at polio, which is my way in.
Yep.
This kind of reverse engineering all of those events makes the rest of it all right there. All one big probability, this is how it went. So when you speak of it in large terms like that, yeah, it's a very present kind of reality.
Well, we do know that later on in the 30s and then into the 40s, we had things like the Tuskegee experiments where they were giving whole communities of African Americans syphilis, and then making sure they didn't get any treatment for their condition, and then watching how the disease progressed through their lives, which was a horrendous thing to do to people. But we that's a very blatant and well known and well studied crime against Americans. But that's not a unique circumstance, is it? They were doing all kinds of different things throughout our early 1900s and into 1910 through 1940.
Right. If you want to slap a year onto this as the date for this beginning,
wow.
Because before that time, most of the real human experiments were not intentional. They were from the researchers themselves. You know, what happened to the pure research.
Yeah.
Now, they didn't set out to do that, but they certainly knew that they had very dangerous material for them, and time would bear it out how dangerous it was. And given the timing of their death and the death of people like Thomas Edison's tech assistant, 1898, it was becoming self-evident that these were very dangerous materials.
Yeah.
So that's why you can just encapsulate this time period and say, well, amongst researchers, they knew. They have not.
So what you've been able to say here, Jennifer, is that because the community that was privy to the inside information that these elements and these things are dangerous, then to see them used in public policy, that's evil. That's evil, and it carries on with the group that has shown itself to be married very closely to this eugenics idea.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're starting to see the roots of this. Now, when you understand that, like I said, the Flexner brothers' roots into the New York Jewish community that has shown itself to be part of the supremacist group that we've been looking at here, and you've heard our research, what it's found. I mean, I'm not coming from a postulation that doesn't have evidence. We've sussed out all of these facts, and now we're seeing another element, a very evil element of control that was this being used of poisoning. I mean, then you go into the 40s when they got into the nuclear testing, and it gets even worse, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, because all of this starts taking a developmental path, and what happens in government, there's a lot of cooperation to this as things become compartmentalized. You know, the growth of a bureaucracy, we experience that today. We have so many departments who have full-time work of developing their ideas and their programs.
Yeah.
So you have something very similar happening. See, all this compartmentalization taking place. And each little unit of this, you know, gets its sweet attention for taking on one aspect.
Well, now I, I'm going to urge my listeners to do parallel research to what you've done, Jennifer, and add value if they can to this by sending me emails on this information. But I really hope, because they're really good. You have to know that the people who listen to this program, many of them are quite skilled researchers in their own right, and they will find new information about this, and I will post it on my site and add value to what you've been doing. But let's move into the 50s here, where bomb testing started.
I want to say something about Linus Lesson.
Okay.
Before we do that.
Yeah.
He had, once he became the director of the Rockefeller Institute, in 1901, he didn't take on any other work. He didn't do anything else. He was just the director of this institute. He retired in 1935. When I looked back at his research and I went right to the source of the publication for it, which is the Journal of Experimental Medicine. That's a publication that he edited.
Mm-hmm.
He was responsible for selecting all of the articles and all the material and all the research that published through him. And makes it very clear by demonstration that he personally was shepherding the research of polio. It was his baby all the way.
Okay.
Nothing of any benefit came out of this regarding polio. So during his career, he was able to babysit this information and keep anyone else from having it. It hasn't happened. But things were happening in the world of that.
Yeah.
Jonas Salk, who would eventually come and develop the polio vaccine after the big Spanish flu, he was marshaled by the military to develop a flu vaccine. So vaccines were very much on the minds of researchers. It's also clear from these publications that they had, you know, a task of developing pharmaceuticals. They were after making serums. They wanted commercial products. There was no doubt that this was what was on their mind. The way they phrased their conclusions, that with confidence that they will find some type of a medicine for this condition. So, very clearly, they were looking for some commercial development of their research. And then we see the military in this picture. The world of vaccines may have been independent research that they were doing. But, interesting that nothing really happened with polio until after Simon Fleckman's time.
Ah, okay.
So, in a sense, all of American society gets put on hold for the war effort and gets channeled into that. And that especially applies when you talk about scientists. Almost any researcher at the time would become kind of military and given a job.
Yep.
So, just put the brakes on independent research. There really was no independent research. And right after the war, to happen. What had happened, though, before the war, just to further demonstrate the mindset, the funding, how all of this happened. Ernest Lawrence, who became very famous as a physicist, he established the Lawrence Laboratory at Berkeley.
Yep.
Today it's Lawrence Livermore, but they still just call it the Berkeley Lab. Was a theoretical physicist.
Yep.
And in order for him to build a lab and get funding for his lab, he devised a strategy for fundraising where he was promising certain types of research in order to fund the building of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And he needed a lot of money. It was expensive for him. They were in a trial and error kind of mode prior to the 30s. And they had pretty much built this one machine. It was a particle accelerator. And they thought, just like putting radon in water, it's like taking radium and finding medical applicants for it, they would do the same thing. That through this particle accelerator, they could take this rather unknown kind of activity, radiation, find a medical application for it. So his early contracts were about developing medicine and procedures. and he got enormous amount of funding through the Rockefeller Foundation.
Now, when they put all the scientists that were available, physicists at the time, Teller and the rest, to build the first nuclear devices, of course, and then, of course, subsequently, the only humans on Earth to ever use them against human beings was the Americans. But we had somebody take science, turn it into an evil machine, and then use that machine against humanity.
Yes, but it was all done in the name of medicine.
Done in the name of medicine.
Yes, all of it. All our nuclear technology was developed in the name of medicine.
Is that a way to sell it to the researchers, is that you're doing good, or is it that was the way the funding channels had been set up by the Flexners early on?
Well, you tell me. If you can't get funding for your project, certainly going to try and market it to whomever you can. So that's the nature of it. You know, you either have independent wealth to do this stuff on your own, or you're going to have to go market yourself for some purpose. So the nuclear physics of its time marketed itself where the funds were, which was in medicine.
Now we move into the 1950s after the war. We've got countries working with all these scientists they had hired. They're still fast at work, developing bigger and better and nastier stuff. And they need to go out in the backyard and play with their nasty inventions. And of course they began to ignite some of these terrible things in Nevada, vaporizing square blocks of desert, turning it into pieces of glass and whatnot. And they figured out that was maybe dangerous, so they start digging underground to do it, and going out into the Pacific and cooking up some atolls and some islands and displacing people. And in fact, what I remember reading was that some people, they didn't even ask them to leave, and they wanted to find out what it would do to these Palauans and Polynesians, you know, when they came in contact with a bomb blast. But what we started seeing is not only did the Americans start lighting off these devices, but we saw the Russians soon after light their own off, and the British tried their own, and the French, of course, in the 1950s tried their own. And so we had these bomb blasts going off left, right, and center all over the planet, didn't we?
Yeah, it boggles the mind, in fact, how much radioactivity is being spread around. You know, I went looking for numbers, and I mentioned this before in the first interview that I did on. I had been struggling to find some equivalent of how many Hiroshima bombs, because you all have a mental picture of that. I was beginning to flounder somewhere around 10,000, but, with some help from a book called Low-Level Radiation, High-Level Cover-Up. Leslie Bertheus is the main part of that book. The people who wrote this book, the two doctors who wrote it, put their finger on about 40,000 bombs worth of radiation.
Hiroshima bombs, yeah.
Yes, having been reduced to that.
Now, what we find and what we discovered through people such as somebody who's been on my program twice, Dr. Ernest Sternglass, and I've been in close contact with since his interviews, and hopefully we're going to do some more work with Ernest, he realized by looking at some data sets that some of the bomb testing that went on in the Nevada test facility, the fallout was following a rather particular tract across the country, was it not?
Yeah, well, it follows the tract of weather. And even though I don't have any specific information on that, because we know that weather moves from west to east. So placing a test site up in the west means that fundamentally your whole country is going to get blanketed with fallout once the dust moves through the weather system. And I have to say something. We know from Chernobyl that this radiation went all the way around the world.
Yep.
If people didn't know it before, they knew it then.
Mm-hmm.
So having this kind of quantity of material blasted into the atmosphere took it all over the planet. Nobody escaped it. These clouds went everywhere. There was a little pollution experiment that was done And not very recently, in fact, a little rubber ducky experiment. They released all these rubber ducks and wanted to see where the ocean currents would take them. And they went everywhere. So we know this is the way our atmosphere circulates, this is the way our ocean circulates. Everywhere.
But there was a rather particular track that was happening in the mid-50s that was coming right out of through your Midwest into your area of Memphis, Tennessee, and into Pennsylvania, and then across New England. That showed some very bizarre associated data as a result of these tests. The problems with IQ, problems with behavior, problems with a spontaneous abortion, problems with leukemias and death from early death from different diseases, including a whole host of diseases that they had claimed had a bacterial or viral base, but rather were just and what the link that you made that when I talked to you was that when your immune system gets weakened by chemicals and by radiation in the environment, you become a perfect host for this next level of elimination, if you will.
Hmm. That's one way to put it.
Hmm.
And that situation was already well underway from the spread of chemicals. Spread of agricultural chemicals.
Yeah.
And that started pretty early on.
With the DDT and so forth.
You know, DDT's been around a long time.
Yeah.
It was invented in 1873.
Well, because, and it was used everywhere because it was effective at what they were trying to get under control, but which one of them was malaria and stuff, was it not?
Yeah, malaria, yellow fever. People were terrified of these were plagues. I guess Europeans never got over having, taken a hit from bubonic plague. This put a fear of plague into civilization. And we know that living in civilized ways, we're very vulnerable to that. So, that's just another systemic area, if you will.
Oh, so this is like somebody afraid of getting a sunburn, so they peel off their skin. I mean, the insanity of it, because ultimately DDT is another immune suppressor, and your immune system becomes overtaxed by the poisons of the environment as well as this radiation. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the radiation because you looked at some of the data sets that came out with that and the SAT score reductions and so forth. And what did you see when you looked at that stuff, Jenny?
Well, I actually came on that later.
Mm.
What I was looking at, and I was really very specifically tracking polio the best I could. And what I had done first was actually compile a long list that fell under this umbrella of polio.
Yep.
And it was by singling these out and following threads of each particular disease, not only back through time, but back through its symptoms, back all of them. How did they arrive at this decision? Looking at Guillain-Barré syndrome gave me the key. Because I went to, I found a doctor who had testified before Congress.
Is this Doug Rocky?
What's that?
Doug Rocky, Dr. Douglas Rocky?
No, this was a man named Howard Ernovitz. And he has an institute for chronic illness. But he was the man that stood up before Congress that he had learned when he was doing his doctoral research in the lab that they would induce polio by either irradiating or chemical toxic loads, that they would cause polio in their lab animals so that they could experiment on it. So that was it. That was my eureka. I knew that from what he had said, and this was the unequivocal statement of an expert before Congress, that polio was caused by radiation chemicals.
So my question to you is, what indication is that they knew this well in advance, and maybe the disease conditions that we're placing across the nation are not by accident?
Well, I think that was pretty early on.
Yeah.
I think right on in the water in 1903.
Yeah.
Might have been an attempt to start exploring this. And that's all that they gave themselves the mandate to do, was to explore. So by
So we have been a bunch of lab rats here.
Yeah.
Ooh. Well, now you, again, when I talked to Dr. Sternglass about this, what he told me was that that there are a whole host of ailments, both sociological ailments as well as physiological ailments that come as a result of radiation exposure. And you all know today, ladies and gentlemen listening, that high levels of uranium, depleted uranium, are showing up worldwide now. I mean, they dug out a soil sample in the Midlands in Britain, all the way around the world from where they were detonated, and it was clearly rootable back to the use of depleted uranium in both Serbia during that Kosovo conflict, as well as Iraq in the 90s and up until today, ladies and gentlemen, using this disastrous and murderous munition. But there is something else that I told you about, Jennifer, that just in advance of 1990, the World Health Organization arrives in Baghdad, and you mentioned that they gave an inoculation to every child in that country in a very short time.
Yeah, that was in 2003. This is current. This could not be less current. This has to do with right now.
So they added an element that is going to certainly create disease environments for everyone there.
Yes. When you give someone a vaccine, you're inducing a personal toxic load system. And in the jargon, they call that sensitizing. But it's compromising your immune system, what it is. That's the action that it is. So this was a world-scale deployment. They took 14,000 health workers and shipped them into Iraq on a mission to inoculate 5 million children in 5 days. And they started this on February 18th, which is exactly to the day, 1 month before the invasion. So this was the war before the war.
Well, let's talk a little bit about vaccines. You know, we're kind of bouncing around here because we're doing this as kind of a file that and kind of jogs people into thinking a lot of different ways outside the box. Well, you told me about an event down in Africa where, and I mentioned I had already heard of this, where the World Health Organization, again, our criminal buddies over there, went into a country in Africa and then gave them smallpox vaccine, and lo and behold, in a short time later, this whole region where they gave these vaccines all broke out with HIV/AIDS.
Yeah, they gave them polio vaccine.
Well, smallpox was in this particular dosage, and then there was a trans African corridor where they gave polio. And that same event came. Now, we're talking about people like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who works with the WHO, that goes to these third world areas and inoculates them, and then lo and behold, that same area comes down within a year or two time with terrible outbreaks of fatal diseases and actually population-changing diseases. Now, This is an evil smoking gun, in my view.
In my view also. You know, during the 50s, you wanted to talk about the history of vaccines in this period of time. We just discussed the conditions of having massive amounts of radioactive fallout everywhere on the globe. And it was very interesting to me that polio vaccines would go public right in the middle of this time period. So the real heavy tonnage of airborne radioactivity started in the 50s when we had H-bombs coming out.
Yep.
You mentioned Teller, and that was his base. He was the father of the H-bomb. And in 1950, Truman ordered up the bomb. Go by historical facts, the first test didn't occur until 1951, and that happened in the Boston test site in Nevada, possibly Mexico, actually. But when that happened, know, it was just a matter of time before all these other countries would have this technology also. And that's exactly how it went. They were just slightly behind by a couple of years, so that this whole entire atmosphere of radioactive take on this building proportion. And in the mid-50s, it was beginning to peak. This time, the polio vaccine goes public. And in the trials, initially, millions of people were inoculated during this shot. Very, very wide-scale thing. Not unlike what happened in Iraq, right before the invasion.
Yep.
So, they got some really off-the-charts kind of results from that vaccine. In Massachusetts, for example, the polio, they got one of the highest vaccine scores, almost 700% in polio. So
they gave the vaccine, and then all of a sudden everybody starts coming down with it.
Right. So when you look back, if you were to only look at the vaccine, you would say, well, the vaccine causes this disease. Because it's a very direct relationship from getting the vaccine to having polio go right through the
system. And then, but of course, they seeded the ground. I mean, they prepared the ground before they sowed the seeds here. Was what they did is they got everybody's immune system overtaxed with radiation and then gave it the dose that was necessary to get them sick.
Assuming they knew that. So.
Well, of course, they've repeated it now here, is my point.
Well, we see it repeated here. And for that reason, it begs the question, is that what they were doing then?
Well, so my question now to you is this, does this take on, in your mind, a new eugenics kind of events that are taking place worldwide?
Well, I think the eugenics events are self-evident in research. You look back at history, that eugenics ideas play themselves out then. You're just standing on the possibility to bring it up through time. So you throw radioactivity into the mix. You throw vaccines into the mix. And now you're both doing this on a very, very wide scale.
Wow. Well, here's what we do on the French Connection, Jenny. You haven't listened to many of our shows here, but the first time someone visits my show, and we usually do repeat visits, is how I usually do this. First one is a general discussion about the subject. We talk all kinds of different things. We bring up and postulate and make connections and suppositions. And then I put it out to my listeners to add value if they have anything to add. Hopefully they will. And then I ask you to come back with a more specific and more tailored discussion on elements within the original discussion we had, so that more clarity can be brought to the discussion. And I think we work backwards from a general into a more specific, so that we can lead people into a understanding of these facts in a very profound way, rather than doing a quick bump and run kind of thing on this and then leaving the subject. I would rather bring everybody up to speed on all of these problems in stages, so that what we'll have in after two or three visits of this information is a profound understanding of just how this has all come together, and we'll also get the impetus of the listeners as well. So what I'd like to do now is maybe ask you to move on to an area that we'd like to talk about later, because there's more to this story. This is a huge story. This is a story that could go on for dozens of hours of time, and we could go off onto all kinds of threads and tangents. But when you were doing this research, what was it about this that shocked you the most? Because you've always tried to spend your life avoiding taking chemicals into your own body. But what I've discovered is that the way the world is set up, if you're alive, you're sucking in piles of them. if it's coming in form of radiation, or it's coming in the form of a Chilean grape, it doesn't matter how or what you do in this life, you're going to get a whole bad dose of this stuff. And on top of that, now they're starting to make inoculations mandatory in a lot of places. So my point being is...
You know, Edwards and that, you mentioned Bill and Melinda Gates. I do believe, Carol, that they are the people who brought us vaccines and tomatoes. And the next waves of this are already upon us. Now, if they can inoculate your fruits and vegetables with vaccines, then the only way that you can avoid that, of course, is by your own. So it gets even larger. Even if you never submit to any kind of medical treatment at this point, that there are other ways which still administer a medicine to you. And that's why, to me, finding out about radon in the water and subsequently everything that's followed, including fluoridation in water, having to put iodine in public water, they dump radioactive waste in public water.
Yes, the sodium fluoride is actually a byproduct of that process, is it not?
Radioactive sodium. You know, something that Lawrence learned at Berkeley Lab was that they could cause almost any chemical to be radioactive. Some were better than others. And they were really specific looking for things that they could mass produce, things that would be used as medicine that was easy to make. In fact, the first nuclear reactors were built for this purpose because they were very efficient at creating lots of radioactive material. And they went from kind of chunk particle accelerators to nuclear reactors. That's how we got nuclear reactors. But, you know, when it's so pervasive in the environment that even your food is going to be delivery systems for medication, then this is what you have to take into account.
Well, Dave, they're actually, and let's go on a little bit of a thread here for people. When you get your fruits from a foreign country into America, they have to go through a, when they come in on a ship, they get off on an individual truck. The truck has to drop off its whole big trailer into an enclosed area, and then gamma radiation is bombarded into the food. And what it does, it kills all of the attached bugs and mites and all kinds of stuff, but it also destroys most, if not all, of the most important vitamins in there, because what it does is it breaks down the vitamin content. Now, you get a perfect looking vegetable or fruit, but you get a sterilized vegetable or fruit. And so it ends up on your shelf looking, gleaming at you, shining, looking good, but it's got no taste, and it's got no content that's wholesome for the body. So again, they're using radiation to deprive us of the benefits of food.
Well, you know, John D. Rockefeller himself set a business model for being efficient. And one of the ways he became, you know, the rich man that he was by selling waste, by turning waste into a commodity and having it applied for other purposes and selling it. So, with a great big huge nuclear industry, we've got all this nuclear waste. Now, we know we don't know how to dispose of it safely, if that can ever be done. But turning it into something useful as a commodity for other industries is the Rockefeller model of business.
Mm-hmm.
And so nuclear waste has another life as sterilizing or agricultural products.
Or it has tumor-creating elements for our seafood that comes onto our tables.
Massive amounts of military waste, radioactive material has been dumped in the ocean.
Mm.
And, of course, you know, land-based industries are notorious for dumping their waste into river systems.
Polychlorinated biphenyls.
Spreading it out on top of the land.
Yeah.
All of it. So... I don't even know what to say about it next. You know, what concerns me a whole lot at this point is where medicine is going with psychological pharmaceuticals.
Well, you know that they're finding Prozac and a whole host of other chemicals in all the groundwater in America now. I mean, you can't get a glass of water out of your tap that's not full of pharmaceuticals, trace elements inside it.
Right, but It's even worse than that. I mean, we're actually experiencing the pressing of this wave of every kind of mind control that can be delivered chemically.
Yeah. It's a scary place to be knowledgeable, isn't it, today? I mean, you know, I pride myself on the effort I make to get things out and get things understood, but I'm always finding myself sickened and even frightened by what I discover. You know, it doesn't matter if it's about pedophilia in our elites or use of poisons or the Monsantos of the world killing our bees It doesn't matter, Jennifer. Everywhere you look, there's a new, sick, and disturbing story to tell.
Well, it just makes you stop and consider the scope.
Mm.
And then you make a decision about yourself.
Yep.
Your life. And we are at that place. If we take in the scope of this, and people are getting very hip to doing it, they, you know, something you feel, is life changing?
I think it is, and I think that's one of the attractions that we've been able to grow from here on the French Connection, because I don't feel powerless in the face of these facts, but rather I believe that ultimately it will empower not only the listeners, but being the tip of the spear on a lot of these facts and bringing them out in a way where people actually understand them at the end of the investigation, it empowers them to make decisions based upon real evidence. And, you know, when they go forward with the story into the next level, that being their families, friends, people around them, or in their communities, political conversations, they're armed correctly. They're given the right amount of tools to do good works out there. And I think that's the real goal of what I do here, and what you're trying to do here is that we want people to take these informations and do good works with them. So what I'm going to suggest, ladies and gentlemen, is that you will note that Jennifer will be back to do a further study of this. We're going to get deeper into some of the inoculations and how they've actually been taking effect across our country and the world. And we're going to talk about projects that were done. And she's got a whole host of information that she's studied up on. And we're going to bring the picture a little clearer. At the same time, I'm going to try to parallel that with an interview with Dr. Ernest Sternglass, of course, the father of the anti-nuclear movement in America. Started back with John F. Kennedy, was his first meeting with the president, and he got Kennedy to actually take notice of what we were doing in the environment with nuclear waste and nuclear bombs. And so he's been a wealth on my programming early on. He was on the first couple of months that I began doing radio shows. I'm going to have him back. And so I'm going to try to do several things on this, Jennifer, and make it as complete a study as I can, given my small resources here.
Well, I'm happy to keep anything I can.
Well, you did today. Again, it was a general discussion about a lot of subjects, and we did cover a lot of ground today on all kinds of things. But what I would like to leave people with is that it is the same usual. It's the same usual suspects that we've been discussing. It always roots back to them. And so that gives me the clear indication that this is a sinister and intentional situation that we face with these inoculations. And I think the day's a number, Jennifer. I think there is a universal awakening happening around the world. And I don't think it's something that they will be able to stop, because I think people are actually thirsting for more. When, you know, oftentimes people won't act until their back is against the wall. I think that is something quite human. And I think everybody's starting to feel that wall against their back right about now.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, been a great show, and I want to thank you for coming on the French Connection. We've put in our hour plus time here, and we will be doing more on this subject with our guest here and future guests, different types. So please, Jennifer, thank you so much again.
Thank you. Thank you, Daryl. I appreciate the time.
Ladies and gentlemen, until the next time, take care of your families, please. Be, you know, if you're the man of the house, be the leader that you know you can be with them. Be the male role model in your home, and be that strong family figure that you know you can be. And ladies, take care of your homes as though there is great threat out there, because there is. And we need people, we need the first building block of a good society, a strong family, to defeat these people. Until the next time, this is Daryl Breakfast Smith telling you all, please, be well. Bye-bye now.
Dry martini, jigger of gin. Oh, what a spell you got me in. Oh, do I feel high? People don't believe me. They think that I'm just bragging, that I could feel the way that I do and still be on the wagon. All I need is one of your smiles, sunshine of your eyes.